John Harrison Nichols, associate editor of the Capital Times and Washington correspondent, or I think they have a different title for it now, like political correspondent for The Nation. What is your damn title with The Nation now?
I think it's national correspondent.
National correspondent.
Okay. Yeah.
And one of your compadres on this afternoon.
Harry Berman?
Mm-hmm. We had a good conversation. He's a smart fellow.
He is really, was not only smart, he did a really hard thing. He set out about 5 years, you know, most of us who do this gig, we like to do things fast, you know, so you like, tell me about something, I'll write about it that day, you know, or the next day. Harry set out about 5 years ago to explore voting rights, I mean, really to get to the heart of the matter. And, you know, it led him back deep into the battle for the Voting Rights Act and all sorts of other things. And so he did this incredible book. I mean, his book is really cool.
I gave him a little grist for the mill.
Uh-oh.
Talking about one of the reasons Scott Walker has power is that many years ago, the Republicans got the Democrats to cave and made the gubernatorial term a four-year term that's always in off-year elections when fewer people vote.
You're still right. I mean, in fact, I actually believe that the 1967 reforms in Wisconsin, which almost nobody will remember, there was a series of referendums that Warren Knowles, of all people, put on the ballot. And the Democrats and Republicans all backed them. You went to four-year terms. You collapsed the lieutenant governor's office into an extension of the governor's office. Because until then, lieutenant governor was elected separately, right?
Mm-hmm.
You could have a Republican governor, a Democratic lieutenant governor, which is democracy, right?
Right.
You know, it means that the second person that people would like to have as governor, if the sitting governor goes out, isn't some, you know, political ally of the governor. It's somebody that people elected. And they did all sorts of other things. They really began a process of diminishing the down ballot offices.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went to the 4-year term and they went to the 4-year off year election model. I mean, there are all these things
well,
they did.
Well, it's interesting. And Missouri is a far more
Missouri is a far more
conservative state than Wisconsin, but they are more likely to have a Democratic governor. They do more people vote and there are enough ticket splitters, they end up with Democratic governors many times.
And a Democratic senator, I might add.
Well, using the word loosely.
No, he's actually, I mean,
Missouri?
Missouri's going to get a Democratic senator.
No, no, he's fine. I'm talking about that.
Oh, no, no, no. I'm talking about the race
issue. No, I know. No, no, no. That's great. He's got the best ad running this year so far.
You see that ad?
Blindfolded, putting a semi-automatic assault rifle together blindfolded. Yeah.
Apparently, like one of the top Republicans, you know, they asked him about it. And, you know, you're supposed to, like, always diminish your opponent's stuff. And uh-huh. The guy goes, this is a pretty good ad.
Yes, it is a good. And you probably knew I was going to like that ad.
Yeah, you're going to like it. Well, you know, I mean, you know why he can do it. And it sort of has a double. I don't know if people have seen the ad. The ad is they're accusing the Democratic Senate candidate in Missouri of being weak on guns. Okay? So in the ad, he's standing in a warehouse, blindfolded. And he starts the ad blindfolded. And he picks up, do you know the weapon? I don't know I'd be careful about it.
I can't remember. It's been a while since I've saw it. It's either an AK-47 or an AR-15.
It's a high-powered weapon. And he puts it together, basically. He puts, basically does all the basic steps to put the clip in, to cock it, to get it all ready, blindfolded. And there's some pretty complicated stuff on assembling and everything like that. And he does it while talking, right? It's not like he's feeling around. He's clearly learned. And, of course, you know why he can do that, right? It wasn't something he trained to do for the ad. He was stationed in Afghanistan. He learned to do night patrols where you put your weapon together at night. And you learn to do these things at night. And so it's a doubly powerful ad because anybody who knows his backstory, A, he knows, wow, you know, he's got this skill. He obviously knows his way around guns. But B, it's because he served his country, whereas his opponent did not. And then this final element of it, as he's doing it, you know, instead of just, like, being, you know, kind of like, oh, please vote for me. Right? He also mentions he's for background check. Right?
He
kind of hits all the marks.
Well, you know, this is the absurdity of what happens when people go to Washington. When Ron Johnson first started running for Senate, he admitted he knew absolutely nothing about guns. He was a fisherman, but he wasn't a hunter, which is fine.
Right.
So yeah. He says something about people registering their guns, like at the DMV. Now, I'm not for gun registration. Yeah. So Russ Feingold, who's thought far more about the Second Amendment than Ron Johnson ever has. Ron Johnson is now just simply an automatic vote for the NRA. No, he hasn't questioned them at all.
Yeah. Well, that's the problem, because people who don't know anything about guns, right, are in many ways the most susceptible to the NRA's. And, you know, the NRA is a corporate lobby, right? I mean, it's a lobby for gun manufacturers. And the people that are most susceptible to it are the people that don't know anything about guns. Whereas somebody like this, you know, Jason Kander guy in Missouri, he knows guns. And so he's, you know, yes, to defend their Second Amendment rights. He knows his way around guns, but he is for background checks.
Let me ask you, since this is such a schizophrenic segment.
Gone off the deep end.
Yeah, no. It's good. It's
interesting.
I like our schizophrenic segments. The Senate race is across the country. Do you think the Democrats are going to capture the U.S. Senate?
Yes, I do. Although they're not going to capture it as easily or as smoothly as they should, simply based on the seats that are up and the pattern. Because at this point, I mean, depending on how Clinton does, at this point, Clinton is underperforming. Not just as an opponent to Trump, but she's underperforming as a Democratic nominee in a cycle like this. And so that is a little bit of a drag on the Senate races, just on turnout and a host of other things. If Clinton surges, and I'll tell you from the polls that I have seen in the last few days, I think there's the hints of that. If she were to have a really good debate on Monday, if things really went well, then I would tell you Democrats could get to like a 53, right, in the Senate. They could really pick up a number of seats. If Clinton kind of wins but doesn't win by much, if it's a rougher game, then my sense is that Democrats at least get to 50, right? They get to 50, and then Kane casts the deciding vote. That's a much tougher way to organize the Senate, though.
It is. Wisconsin, Illinois look like they're in pretty good shape for Democrats.
I think New Hampshire.
New Hampshire, North Carolina has suddenly become a very competitive state, and a lot of political insiders think Burr's going to lose.
Yeah, I think there's a real good chance, although North Carolina, there's a lot going on in North Carolina, right? So
is there?
It's a complex game.
Oh,
yeah.
Is there? Yeah.
But I would throw one other one on there that everybody forgets when they're running down the list. Katie McGinty, whatever you want to say about her, over in Pennsylvania, she continues to hold that lead. You know, and we're ticking toward October, and it does look like Katie McGinty can win Pennsylvania and beat Toomey. If she does, so that's your four right there. Illinois, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, New Hampshire.
Yeah, conversely, the problem this seems this year for the Democrats is Nevada.
Yes, and that's why you need, remember, there's potential you may need five. They may need to win five to get four, right? Because they may lose Nevada. And if they lose Nevada, well, that's, you know.
That puts you back in a hole, right.
Yeah, and but
you know, Harry Reid does have a way of getting those culinary workers out to vote, doesn't he?
He's a very good organizer. I think this comes to Clinton. I really do. I'm going to tell you flat out. If Clinton surges, if she moves numbers and actually, you know, gets to where she should be there, my sense is that she probably gives just enough of a pull. Because they have a good Democratic candidate for the Senate. She's not a bad player at all. She should be doing well. And it's about a tie there.
Yeah. Well, they have a pretty good candidate in the Republicans, too, in that state.
Republicans is one of their best presentations, he does a very good job as a candidate. So, and it's sort of like, you know, you got a couple of these races around the country where, in my opinion, the Republicans are doing well based on the skills of their candidate. And one, of course, is Nevada. The other is, you know, love or hate him, it's Ohio. Portman has run, you know, they're going to be teaching Portman's campaign in campaign manager school.
Well, that's why, you know, I think everybody thought, well, Wisconsin, you know, Russ Feingold's going to come back and it's easy. He's running a good campaign. Ted Strickland didn't run a good campaign.
That's exactly right. And you see, I also think that Chuck Grassley in Iowa was vulnerable this year.
But he's running a good campaign.
And I think they've done a poor job of challenging him.
She's a loser. I saw her on TV. Woo! John.
Well,
bad, you know, candidate.
Sort of like, here's a tip for you. If you're going against a guy who you might want to be suggesting has been around the Senate for too long,
yeah,
and has become kind of a crotchety old mean guy.
Don't pick Irene Ryan from the Beverly Hillbillies.
Well, maybe don't pick somebody who's his contemporary.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation with us. Donald Trump seems to think he has a solution to the crime problem in Chicago. This is what he said day before yesterday.
Ray Kelly did a great job, and New York was not in a Chicago situation, but it was really in trouble. It was in bad shape crime-wise, and with all of the shootings and everything. And Rudy Giuliani did a great job as mayor. And they really straightened things out with stop and frisk, and it was used further by the next mayor, Bloomberg. And now they just, you know, recently, not so recently, but fairly recently, they stopped it. But stop and frisk worked. We had tremendous numbers of shootings. Now, Chicago is out of control. And I was really referring to Chicago with stop and frisk. They asked me about Chicago, and I was talking about stop and frisk for Chicago.
Stop and frisk, is that going to solve the crime problems in Chicago? Are you there, John?
No, it's not going to. No. But, you know, it's interesting because, you know, one wonders whether Donald Trump has spent a lot of time paying attention at all to the news, right? He lives in New York City. He knows that stop and frisk was an issue in the last mayoral campaign, and he knows it's one of the reasons that they elected a different mayor.
Well, that's true. Bill de Blasio was actually on Rachel Maddow last night talking about this, and he said it actually will make it harder to fight crime.
Crime is down.
Right, in New York City. Right.
Down. Yeah,
which has to be a great disappointment for Rudolph Giuliani.
Yeah. Well, you know, look, I thought it was very interesting the other day. There was a video that went viral, and it was a video of a police officer stopping a couple of very young African-American kids. I mean, these probably, I would think, like 6, 7, maybe 8-year-olds on their bikes, and asking them their names, and really, you know, being, you know, pretty pointed in his questioning, or nothing terribly awful, but just, it's got to be a little scary for kids, or maybe it is. And an older African-American guy came up and said, what are you doing to the police officer? And the police officer is like, well, we've got an incident here. We're looking for people who've stolen bikes or something. And he said, do you think these little kids did that? You know, and the police officer was saying, well, we're just checking, you know, we're just doing. And the older guy, you know, kind of kept pressing the police officer on, you know, why are you doing this? I mean, what possible logic is there in what you're doing here? And finally, the police officer folded up his book and, you know, kind of said, well, you know, but walked away, right? And that police officer wasn't a horrible guy, right? But he was kind of going on autopilot. And he was undoubtedly doing something, you know, and stopping those kids that has potentially have long-term ramifications, you know, just in how they may view a police officer, how they may respond. And good community policing, where officers are on the streets, where they know everybody in the neighborhood where they're really connected in a good way. Good community policing, I think, allows officers to know kids, to know who they're working with, and to, you know, and to know adults as well, obviously, and to form those relationships that A, make a neighborhood much safer, but B, also help to build, you know, kind of a long-term sense of connectedness between police officers and their community. So there really are, you know, there are different approaches. There are different strategies. There are strategies that make this right, that make it work. And there are people across this country, police officers, police union folks in some cities, police chiefs, police commissioners, who really are working hard at getting this thing right. And then you have Donald Trump sort of pop in with his, you know, instant that he read something in a paper or something occurred to him. And
well, you know, Rudolph Giuliani is one of his top advisors.
Yeah, but yeah. Giuliani, you know, thinks it's not exactly like Giuliani is viewed. Let me put it this way. If Giuliani wants to test out the popularity of his ideas, maybe he should run for mayor of New York again. See how he does.
Well, it is, you know, it's interesting. You can go
Republican primary.
In you know, New York did have a serious crime problem for a while, and maybe in the short term, stop and frisk may have stopped some criminals, but there were long term consequences, and of course it was unconstitutional. But if you go back to the 1960s and John Lindsay's reelection for mayor, which was an oddity in 1969,
yeah.
Right? One of the things he pointed out to, he was still on the ballot even though he lost the Republican primary. Was because he'd also run as a liberal. This is before he became a Democrat. He pointed out to people that the riots that took place in Detroit and Milwaukee and many other cities didn't happen in New York, and that's because he went to the streets. He
went out and walked.
Right, he went out. Right. That makes a difference.
Famously, makes a huge difference. Famously, on the night that Martin Luther King Jr. was killed, Bobby Kennedy, right. Not only did he go and do his outdoor rally in an African American neighborhood, I believe in Indianapolis, but he had actually announced, I believe, the shooting of King to the crowd. The crowd did not know until he told them. And, you know, think about that. That trust level, that sense of connection, that sense that everybody's going to know how to handle this and how to respond to this. Because we're all talking to each other and we're all connected to each other. And when you break that connection, right, when you create divisions and barriers and walls and all these things that Donald Trump wants to talk about, I genuinely think you make things worse.
All right. Now, that said, I do think there are people on either side that are fanning the flames of division that simply do not want the police and African-American residents to have a good relationship. It is not in their political agenda, and they are doing everything they can to stoke the flames of violence. And that's very dangerous. The Nation of Islam leader has said some really horrible things over the last couple days that I think are extremely dangerous. Hello?
Yeah.
Okay.
I have to be honest. I haven't heard those quotes, so I'm
right.
A little bit on the
well. Go
on
look
the form side here.
Yeah. Well, go. You know, here's the point. And I hear this from I hear this in Madison. I hear this from Brandy. I hear this from Matthew Brongen. They don't like community policing, and they don't like the idea of cops building relationships with people in communities. They think they should control that, and they want the cops out. And I don't think that's I don't think that's realistic.
Well, you know, I think that look. Here's an interesting thing. You know, I've always tried to figure this one out. You help me with this one, okay? We elect sheriffs, but we don't elect police chiefs. How come that? Why is that?
I would have no problem with electing police chiefs. But I suspect if you put Mike Koval on the ballot, he'd do very well.
He'd probably win.
Yeah.
He might do very well.
Yeah.
That's fine.
But that's not Brandy's point.
Well, but it is my point. And I think it's an important one. because
John, my point is there are people on the other side that are stoking the flames of violence because it's part of the MO. I mean, Charlotte didn't just happen by accident. It took a number of forces for that explosion last night. That didn't just happen by accident.
Well, look, in Charlotte, there's obviously a tremendous level of distrust, right, between the police department and at least some folks. And all I'm saying is, I've been very interested, I've been thinking about this a lot. In Tulsa today, the district attorney there, conservative Republican, charged the police officer who shot the gentleman in Tulsa with manslaughter. And he's an elected official. He's got to face the consequences of what he does one way or the other. And, you know, I'm increasingly of the view that that I like the model of the county sheriff. I like the model of the someone's elected.
Well,
this is the answer to your thing, because you're saying, well, some people say this and some people say that. Well, put it to the folks, right? I mean, let's have some political electoral input.
Well, as far as Tulsa goes, let's just remember they had a sheriff who deputized a volunteer who pulled out a gun rather than a stun gun and shot someone dead a couple years ago. That doesn't always work out well.
No. I'm not defending it. But right. What I am suggesting is the district attorney. I was reading up on this guy down in Tulsa who did this charge, and it's the interesting thing. Because you've had you've had all these incidents. Tulsa seems to have not blown up, right? And to have had a remarkable level of kind of community interaction and communication. And it's had a result that not everybody's going to be satisfied with. They're not going to be happy that that it was merely, some folks are not happy that it's merely a manslaughter charge. Some folks are unhappy that there is even a manslaughter charge. But the bottom line is that this elected district attorney chose to charge. And I do believe, you know, maybe I'm just too much of a small D Democrat, but I do believe that a lot of this tension here and this Sturm und Drang can be eased when we put this into the public sphere.
I hate to end the conversation this way.
Okay. All right.
But three times now, the voters of Milwaukee County have elected David Clark.
No, I hear what you're saying.
I'm sorry.
You're not going to turn me against democracy.
I don't think it's an automatic elixir for what ails us. That's all.
It's not a cure-all. All right. Is what you're saying.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for coming on. Appreciate it.
All right.
All right.
Take care.
I have more to say on this in a moment.